Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Hello and welcome back to the Spike Podcast. I'm Fraser Myers and I'm thrilled to be joined as ever by Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Thank you, Fraser. Thrilled as well, as
and
always.
Returning guest, Spike's columnist, Inaya Falarin Iman.
Hi.
We've got loads to talk about today. We'll be discussing the crimes of Hugh Edwards, the trans activist in the Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre, the arrest of Bernadette Spofforth, and the exploding pages in Lebanon. But first, let's chat quickly about the Battle of Ideas. For those of you at home who didn't hear last week, we are doing two live podcasts at this year's Battle of Ideas on the 19th and 20th of October in London. So, Tom, we've got a very exciting lineup.
Absolutely.
On the Spike podcast, as well as you and I. We'll have Graham Linehan, Kathleen Stock, and Raqib Hassan. And do you want to talk a bit about Last Orders?
Yeah, so Last Orders, if anyone isn't aware, is also our Nanny State podcast that I do with Chris Snowden every 2 weeks. We'll be at the battle on the Saturday. So far confirmed is Julia Hartley Brewer and Kate Andrews. So definitely make it along to that as well.
And for viewers and listeners to this podcast or fans of Spiked, you can get a 20% discount on your Battle of Ideas tickets. Just go to battleofideas.org.uk and use the promo code SPIKED24 in the checkout. The promo code is SPIKED24 and that's battleofideas.org.uk. Tom, is there one more thing you want to talk about before we start?
There is. There's another very special announcement, which is as of today, we've just launched our latest Spiked book. This is After the Pogrom, the 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization. It's a new book by Brendan O'Neill, hot off the press, so hot off the press, in fact. This is actually the test copy, which is why it's got this horrible banner across it, yours won't. It's a really powerful, incisive take on the whole post-October the 7th moment and how the West kind of failed the moral test. So that's out now on Amazon. You can find it, you can buy it. We're also going to be having a online event on Tuesday, the 1st of October, which is just for Spike supporters. Bachi Ungasagan, known to many of you, I'm sure, best-selling author and a Spike columnist, will be interviewing Brendan about the book and also taking your questions. So if you are a Spike supporter, go and claim your ticket now. And if you're not a Spike supporter, definitely sign up because you can come to this event as well as many more. So yes, After the Pogrom, go and find it on Amazon.
Buy the book, sign up to the event, don't miss out. So Hugh Edwards was sentenced this week. He was given a suspended sentence, meaning he will walk free. I mean, Tom, some of the crimes he admitted to were extremely lurid. Some of the worst types of child abuse imagery, one of them involving a child as young as 9. There's been a lot of questions raised about the apparent leniency of the sentence. What have you made of that discussion?
No, it has been really striking. On the one hand, it's clear that from a lot of the legal commentary which has happened since, that even though, as you say, he was found to be in possession of 41 child sexual abuse images, 7 of which were the most serious category A. I don't want to go into the details of what that means, but it's bad. It's very, very bad. And yet at the same time, he was given this suspended sentence. He was also not given a sort of specific sexual violence prevention order, which would have allowed the police to kind of monitor his online activities and so on. And I think what's also particularly striking is the sentencing remarks from the judge himself. He seems to take as read a lot of the claims of the defense around Hugh Edwards' sort of mental state, his background, even some of the claims made by the defense about how he hadn't done anything with the images apart from opening them on WhatsApp. And I think just in the context of the discussions that we've been having in recent weeks and months about the seeming severity that the authorities will reserve for people posting obnoxious, offensive, downright racist things on the internet, being sent to prison for weeks, sometimes months on end, in comparison to this, which is not a victimless crime by any stretch of the imagination, I think it's quite naturally raised a lot of those questions again about, we seem to live in a society which seems to see what Hugh Edwards did as less significant, less deserving of punishment than people saying obnoxious things online. And there's something about that which speaks to the age that we live in, really, in which there's so much focus on speech and so little focus on actual criminal action.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and to give one example of someone who was, you know, treated much more harshly for speech, Julie Sweeney, a woman from Cheshire, elderly woman, she said some truly abhorrent things about Muslims, very violent things. And I wouldn't, you know, disagree that those things are horrible. But she was sentenced to 15 months in prison, whereas, you know, even the judge in that case admitted that she was being intemperate. He didn't think that she was deliberately, you know, causing trouble, inciting violence. It was just a hot-headed, heat-of-the-moment thing. And still 15 months in prison, whereas Hugh Edwards walks free.
Yeah, and just on that point about the age that we live in, because the reality is it's actually just a massive disconnect because the public are absolutely mortified by the sentencing, it looks like. And most people look at that and think that that is crazy what happened to, you know, the sentencing when it came to Hugh Edwards. And the way in which a lot of, legal commentators have flooded on Twitter saying, well, actually, like, this is kind of in line with X, Y, Z. And that's not really the point that people are making.
Yeah.
The point that we're making is that actually, you know, is that right? Is that okay? So you can see that disconnect there. And I mean, if you look at some of the, you know, mitigation that that Hugh Edwards tried to say that because he didn't get into Oxford University or Oxbridge, he felt inferior. I mean, it's astonishing that was actually taken as something to be a mitigating factor.
And worthy of repeating in the sentencing remarks and everything.
You know, exactly, for some of the most horrific imagery we're talking about. And, you know, if you even just go back to when The Sun first broke the story in relation to the adjacent issue of him, you know, giving money to a young person that was addicted to drugs for sexual imagery. That was the way the conversation was just shut down completely, saying that, oh, well, he's in a bad place mentally. Mm. And then there was almost just a complete silence, as that was just like, we can't talk about that now.
Yeah.
And actually, I think just the way in which that is being used to actually just obscure the reality of that issue, I think is awful. But in regards to what you said about the cases in relation to the riots, it really does, again, feed into this narrative and feed into what I think this very legitimate idea that there are certain groups and people that are valued in society and others that aren't. And if you are part of the unfashionable group or whatever that group that is not valued, then you are allowed to be treated completely differently by the law.
Yeah.
And I think that that is really damaging.
Yeah. And Luke Gittos did a really good piece on Spike, you know, highlighting some of the ways that, you know, he is also a legal commentator, but he said there were many things that were unusual about this case. Even the fact that it was held in a magistrate's court was unusual. That signaled to Edwards and his defense team that he was going to be sentenced for 12 months or less. That's a luxury many defendants don't have. Actually, most defendants who appear before a magistrate are given short shrift. Sometimes they don't even get to appear in court at all and give their defense and get to write a letter and usually judges ignore their pleas. I mean, someone was showing an example recently, you know, of a man whose car insurance lapsed and he was, he said, I had cancer, my wife had cancer, not considered a sufficient mitigating factor, whereas Hugh Edwards' mental health is considered a major mitigating factor in, you know, this much more grotesque crime.
Mm. And whilst it's impossible to kind of speculate as to why there was such seemingly differential favourable treatment in this particular instance, it is worth saying, as you have pointed to there and I, that throughout this whole saga, there has been a response from certain sections of the great and good to suggest that different standards should apply. Mm. I mean, when this first broke, and you know, as you're outlining there, it's was a very different story then. It was very much about deeply unseemly behaviour rather than anything criminal, given tens of thousands of pounds to this crack-addled teenager in exchange for pornographic images of himself. And yet the kind of refusal to believe that anything untoward had happened, that this wasn't really anything that the newspaper should be reporting on, that this was anything part of a kind of vendetta against the BBC on the part of the Sun newspaper. I'm not even entirely sure who the journalist's politics behind that particular story was. You know, she wasn't speaking for her organisation when she wrote those stories. And the willingness of which it was just dismissed as a troubled private life. Granted, we didn't know quite how complicated that private life, shall we say, to put it lightly, has now turned out to be. But from the off, there has been this sense of he's the wrong type of person to be cast in that kind of light. And surely there is a bit of a problem here where anyone associated with the BBC or seen as a member of the great and good, where maybe there is just that kind of extra level of doubt, extra level of benefit of the doubt, which is extended to them, even in a situation where even what we knew back then was pretty serious, certainly.
Yeah. And you know, it just feels like, as you say, the commentariat going out of their way to defend him, especially, you know, when, to be fair, when a lot of the details weren't known, but it was just so reflexive.
Yeah.
There was like, there was nothing, he's absolutely done nothing wrong. And then I keep coming back to this, you know, this statement by the judge in this case, you know, all kinds of things that where Hugh Edwards' word was taken for it. As you said, Tom, earlier, he accepted that the images were not done, you know, nothing was done with the images. He accepted that Hugh didn't have any gratification from the images. There was also a bizarre distinction made between paying for the images and giving this paedophile, Alex Williams, a gift as a thank you. That sounds like payment to me, but it's a distinction that the judge was determined to get out there in the, you know, in the public domain. It just, you can completely understand why people feel like this isn't, you know, this isn't justice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for the reasons that you just outlined, I mean, most normal, decent human beings would be stop talking to someone, completely report them to the police, think that this is outrageous, disgusting, horrific. But apparently for Hugh Edwards, that was just something to, you know, continue to communicate with somebody in regards to. And the idea that there's all these kind of mitigating factors, I just think leaves a really bad taste in most people's mouth. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
This episode of the Spike Podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. You know what's not fair? The fact that Netflix keeps thousands of films and shows away from you based on your location alone. You could just cancel your subscription in protest, or you could get your money's worth by using ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is a virtual private network that creates a tunnel between your device and the internet. Basically, this lets you change your online location. It allows you to control where Netflix thinks you're located. I don't know about you, but when I'm looking for something to watch, I often look for the shows that my friends have recommended to me. The only problem is, many of those shows are hard to find in the UK. ExpressVPN has solved this by letting me access Netflix servers in 100 plus different countries. Now I can catch up on all the shows that I've missed out on. And the best bit? ExpressVPN is really simple to use. Just open up the app, click one button to change your location, refresh Netflix, and you're all set. ExpressVPN also works on all your devices, and it covers other streaming platforms like Disney Plus and BBC iPlayer. Most importantly, it's super fast, letting you stream in HD with zero buffering. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services while only getting a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/spiked. Don't forget to use our link at expressvpn.com/spiked, and you'll get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. That's expressvpn.com/spiked. This week, Mrudal Vadder, the former head of the Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre, has stepped down. If people don't know, Vadder is a transgender woman, a man who identifies as a woman. A report recently found that during his tenure, essentially the Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre didn't put survivors first. He became very infamous as a trans activist figure, using the centre as a way, in a sense, to re-educate the survivors who appeared there in trans ideology, essentially. Tom, do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
No, it's like the kind of darkest of dark comedies in a strange sort of way, how this all panned out. Because as you say, there's been this particular report which has led to this moment. But this also comes off the back of the tribunal hearing in which Roz Adams, who used to work at the Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre, triumphed. And what came out through that was that Vadder was basically kind of leading a sort of Kafka-esque campaign against Ros Adams because she had raised these concerns about, we've got a lot of service users who want to be reassured that they will have a women-only service, a women-only space. Mm. And that as a consequence of this, she was just branded a transphobe and pushed out. The details are so incredibly striking. Cases of women actually being turned away from the service because they were deemed to be gender critical, their complaints being dismissed as bigoted, even put in a folder called hate emails.
Yeah.
And what was also striking was just sort of how out in the open this was. So Vada gave this interview to the Guilty Feminist podcast way back in 2021. I think we've got a clip of it because it lays it all out pretty starkly.
Yeah, this is pretty astonishing. Have a listen.
Sexual violence happens to bigoted people as well. These spaces are also for you, but please also expect to be challenged. You can't go back to life before traumatic incident or traumatic incidents. But if you have to reframe your trauma, I think it is important as part of that reframing, having a more positive relationship with it.
So you've been raped or abused by a man. You go to a rape crisis center and you say, I don't want men in my space. Mrudal Vada says, you've got to reframe your trauma. You have lessons to learn. You're transphobic. You're a bigot. It's time for you to be re-educated.
I mean, this is, you know, extremely immoral, disturbing, condescending. I mean, it really just reveal like the priorities of so much of kind of trans activism and gender ideology, that you are, if you sign up to this ideology, then that effectively means that it is above all other kind of basic human priorities, whether that's the safety of children, the safety of women, and just basic human decency. If someone's going through something so difficult like that, that is not the time or the place, and it's not your position whatsoever to be doing things like that. And I just think that it's just, if you look at the things that have happened around this issue over the last few years, I mean, it's almost, you could write it that this was going to happen. I mean, if you speak to many of the detransitioners, you know, they say that when it comes to when they went to get advice from, you know, these clinicians, that they it was rushed through. But as soon as they said, actually, maybe this isn't the right thing, then all of a sudden everybody kind of felt uncomfortable. The way this ideology has been institutionalized, where people like Vada can have these hugely senior positions and act in these ways with seemingly impunity for years until it gets to the point where it's almost impossible to not confront the reality of what's happened.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the point, right? You know, how did this person ever get to that place in the first place is itself just extraordinary. It's not an individual's problem.
No, absolutely. And there's been many cases of various institutions which seem to forget what their founding mission is and just give themselves over to kind of one flavor of woke ideology or another. But there's something so profoundly sickening about this particular case, because you have some of the most vulnerable women in society who need to access care, who need that level of support. And yet that is put a tier below the need to either re-educate them or to reaffirm an ideology or the self-identity of the person who happens to be the CEO. And I mean, it was even down to the point where not only were they found to have been turning away people who were deemed to be insufficiently trans inclusive, but also that they had a policy of refusing to refer them to Beera's Place, which is JK Rowling's women only rape crisis center, also in Edinburgh. It's incredibly indefensible. The fact that it's gone on this long is remarkable. I mean, it's as in situations like this, where you have a tribunal or you have some sort of case which rights the wrongs a few years hence, it's kind of nice to know that eventually the system broadly defined works in pushing back against these things. But there's an awful lot of people who have been failed along the way to that, definitely.
Yeah, and it's just so, you know, depressingly ironic. I mean, a lot of the trans activists, you know, constantly saying that women's rights are not in conflict with trans rights. Mm. But if you are literally saying that a woman cannot access particular services unless they believe in a particular view of gender and sex, then that you are taking away their rights.
Yeah.
And so you're literally demonstrating why so many people think these things are in conflict, because actually, you know, you have to sign up to a political ideology in order to actually just have basic services if you're a vulnerable woman.
Yeah, incredible. So one of the people arrested in the post-riots crackdown was a woman called Bernadette Spofforth. She's quite famous on Twitter. She was arrested on suspicion of spreading false communication and of stirring up racial hatred. Thankfully, her arrest has been dropped. The police are going to take no further action. Tom, do you want to tell us a little bit about this case? I mean, she was essentially believed to have been central in sort of spreading the misinformation around, you know, the identity of the suspect of the Southport stabber.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the wake of the Southport killings, there was this name which began to do the rounds on social media, Ali Al-Shakati. There was this claim that this person was the killer. It was obviously falsely claimed that he had come to the UK on a small boat, that he might have been on an MI6 watch list, that he might have been known to the authorities also as mentally ill. Spofforth basically has been named and presented as one of the people who, if not the original source of the claim, certainly someone who was instrumental in spreading them.
Yeah.
There's been a whole lot of reporting which has tried to trace it back. Many people believe she was the first person to tweet about it. She herself says that she... first, she claimed that she got it from someone on the ground in Southport, this particular name. Later on, told the Times that she saw it from another ex-user. That ex-user has since challenged that claim. So there's a whole array of sort of points here. The main thing is she did post that tweet.
Yeah.
It did seemingly become picked up by a lot of various different accounts who were boosting it. She deleted it an hour later, effectively apologised for it. But nevertheless, just slightly more than a week after posting that in the wake of the Southport killing, she was visited by the police. She was arrested. According to her account, she was held for 36 hours whilst they were trying to draw enough evidence. And now, because of a lack of evidence, they have said there'll be no further action. And I think this was a particularly unsettling case for many people, because whilst on the one hand, to spread that kind of information, to not look to corroborate any of those details, despite how even a quick Google would have revealed that, first of all, Shakati seems to just mean my apartment in Arabic, if you roughly translate it. MI6 don't have domestic terrorism watch lists. MI5 deal with domestic terrorism. There's all sorts of things that, if considering the size of your following, you could do pretty minor due diligence and realize that what you were spreading was sort of inflammatory misinformation, effectively.
Yeah.
It's still, I think, concerned and resonated with people, because this was the police going after someone primarily for talking nonsense on social media, for spreading untruths. Granted, with this sort of proviso that if this is true, all hell was going to break loose, as Spofforth put it. But nevertheless, it was one of those things we realised that whilst we've had offences like this on the books for some time, it does feel increasingly that we're moving into the space of the police feeling it's their responsibility and the authorities feeling it's their responsibility to, first of all, kind of manage public discussion of horrendous crimes, terrorist incidents and what have you in real time. And by manage, I mean kind of clamp down hard on what is deemed to be misinformation. As part of that, inevitably, it draws them into the business of deciding and punishing what is and isn't true. And that does feel like a Rubicon we're crossing at the moment, both in terms of what the police are doing, even though it didn't go any further in this place, but also what the demands that are now being piled on social media companies again to do. So as ever, you don't have to defend the action of thoughtlessly spreading something that you might have heard third hand or might have seen doing the rounds on the internet with no thoughts of the consequences. You don't have to defend that, but you certainly have to be appalled by the fact that the state and the police are becoming increasingly in the role of being arbiters of truth, effectively, and all to the end of managing public discussion of certain issues in quite a paternalistic fashion.
Yeah, managing public feeling. Anaya, what have you made of
it? Yeah, I mean, it seems now increasingly that, you know, it could be a crime, or you could be prosecuted or, you know, investigated by the police for being ignorant and wrong. And don't get me wrong, you know, I think it was... very, very wrong-headed, all of the people that shared those claims without really a shred of evidence. But the reality is that as human beings, we're going to make mistakes. We're going to jump on fads. We're going to, you know, share things that might be misleading sometimes. And that should not be a police matter. And quite frankly, during the riots as they were unfolding, there were people that were saying that, for example, Muslim women had acid thrown at her.
Yeah.
And some of those people, I think a gentleman that works for Hope Not Hate, you know,
Nick Lowles.
Yeah, Nick Lowles, you know, there's not really been any consequences, you know, for him in that respect. So it's not only just ridiculous to be prosecuting people without investigating them, but what an extraordinary waste of police resources and police time when we look at some of the things that's actually causing a lot of, you know, anxiety and frustration in society, the de facto decriminalization of so many crimes. And then this is what we're seeing people being pursued at for. But again, it's often this kind of low-hanging fruit as well, because undoubtedly spreading that misinformation is wrong.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think there are, again, deeper questions at play, which political leaders like Keir Starmer would just refuse to discuss. Why is it that actually that claim did actually go viral as well? Mm-hmm. I think part of it, you know, is partly because in some instances, it almost rang true for some people. Now, that doesn't mean that it's okay what happened. But the reality is there is clearly, you know, a sense in society that there are certain patterns or repetitive things happen in society that they can kind of pit on certain people. Now, that's wrong what's happened, but there's no deeper kind of questioning or trying to address that deeper reason. So I think it's just another demonstration of the increasing just authoritarian age that we're in, that every issue, every civic issue, social issue is now going to become like a police matter.
Yeah, it's very worrying. And there is, as you say, and there are reasons why that rumour was able to catch hold, not just because of the pattern, but also because actually this is not the police or the authorities' fault, but the fact that in this terrible case, the suspect was underage and therefore his name couldn't be revealed for the best part of a week. And that information vacuum, you know, that invites people to speculate, unfortunately. And they speculated with something that we know in the past the police have tried to suppress. I mean, there was literally, you know, a terror attack in Hartlepool involving, was it an asylum seeker from Morocco?
Yeah.
And, you know, that was covered up by the police. So I don't want to excuse misinformation, but you can see, or, you know, you can see why people would buy into it because
And that's just, we've just got to be frank about that. But and that's what's so frustrating, again, are, you know, people in the political class, you know, decision makers in government, you know, at least from a public perspective, refuse to have that conversation outright. And so you leave this space open for people to then, you know, fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
And that, I think, makes it more likely that people are going to get things massively wrong.
Mm-hmm. And also why people distrust the authorities in the first place. Now, it's not to say that that is entirely healthy. They're particularly on the part of the kind of bigger influences in this slightly cranky or crank adjacent sort of space. I'm not necessarily talking about them, but certainly people maybe within their audience, people who are trying to make sense of what's going on, wondering why the information wasn't forthcoming. It's also worth mentioning that the police were relatively quick in trying to just sketch out some of the details of the actual Southport attacker, saying that he was born in Cardiff to Rwandan parents and so on. But at the same time, even that didn't necessarily convince anyone. There was still that level of distrust. Now, on the one hand, one shouldn't just say that that excuses people from, you know, believing whatever they read on the internet or whatever. But first of all, we're still talking about a relatively small amount of people. But also, it's worth trying to get to grips with why is there such distrust in the first place? And what was interesting about the way in which the information about the Southport killer was handled was that eventually they did reveal his name and identity before his 18th birthday.
Yeah.
Because they realised it got to a certain point where this, you know, it'd become untenable to withhold this information anymore. If that kind of conversation had happened earlier, a lot of things could have been avoided. And also, as many people have pointed out, this is a way in which they try to manage the situation. There is a presumption that if you provide too much information up front, that you're either going to further fuel the fire, or you're also going to potentially gin up some kind of backlash.
Yeah.
And I think it's as a precise consequence of that it creates this vacuum that we've been talking about. And it's also, I think, especially in the kind of online sphere, because there has been over the years people who have been censored on social media or who have even been, you know, demonized by the authorities for, say, during COVID and lockdown, saying things which actually later turned out to be, if not true, then certainly plausible. There's a lot of people who are struggling to believe what the authorities tell them. So rather than interrogate that and try to work out what's created a climate which is more amenable to these kinds of things to spread and to take root, there's just this reflexive police response, which is only going to fuel the problem further, it feels like.
I want to talk about another case, the free speech case, where there is actually another good outcome. Myra Hussein was arrested and she was found not guilty in court of stirring up racial hatred because she depicted Rishi Sunak and Suella Braverman as coconuts while on a pro-Palestine demo. Now, Anaya, obviously, I don't buy this idea that it's not racist to call a black person a coconut, but it's good news really that she's been let off in a way.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think, you know, she should have been charged. I think this hate speech legislation is intrinsically, you know, a problem for free speech. And in this instance, I think, you know, that does apply in that same way. And I think, you know, when you just read the fact that for for months and months, you know, this woman who is, I think, 9 months pregnant at the point of this trial, you know, she has lost her job and has really just been under this uncertainty of potential, you know, conviction for a poster on a march. I don't think it's a good thing at all, and she should never have been charged in the first place. At the same time, I think a lot of the people, the most vociferous kind of defenders of her, have been, you know, disingenuous to say the least, in the sense that, for example, saying that it's just political satire or it's just a political critique. Obviously, it's a racial slur. You're using someone's race as a way to kind of delegitimize them. And I also think that a lot of her kind of supporters, Dr. Shola, you know, the kind of talking head on various kind of programs and so on, you know, saying that, you know, laws used to protect ethnic minorities are being used against them. Well, actually, hate speech laws don't protect ethnic minorities. Mm. Actually, they shut down discussion and erode kind of trust between people. But I'm sure she's very happy for those laws to be used on her political opponents.
Yeah, and there seems to be this sense that this the law is good, hate speech laws are good, but it's been weaponized in this wrong way this time by, presumably by the racist Tory government, because they would have, you know, were in when this charge was made. But, you know, it's worth reflecting on the fact that actually some of the first people arrested for hate speech in Britain were black.
Yeah.
You know, if you believe, as many anti-racists do, that the law is used disproportionately against people of colour, then why would you support more harsher and restrictive laws? It just doesn't make sense.
And on top of that, it is interesting that some people are saying, oh, well, the police don't understand our intra-community, you know,
racial slurs.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you know, first and foremost, you know, that's not true. I mean, you see rappers all the time using the N-word and they're not convicted of like hate speech, whereas in other contexts, some people may well have been. But what they're really calling for is the end to equality under the law.
Yeah.
You know, that is the basis of what they're saying, which is that the police should be treating people differently on the grounds of race.
Mm.
So, because why should slurs be treated differently if you are of a different racial background? Mm-hmm. I think just logically, if you're going to have the law, it should be applied equally.
Yeah.
But I don't think you should have the law at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a reminder how important it is to be consistent on these particular matters. I mean, it's quite clear that Hussein and her various defenders are not consistent on this issue, to put it lightly. They seem to be only opposed to hate speech legislation when it's their own forms of hate speech, which they're worried about. But at the same time, there's always that tendency on the part of any kind of wing or side of politics to crow and to celebrate, or just to engage in a bit of schadenfreude when people who haven't been holding the line for free speech, to put it lightly, find themselves bitten by it. But I think people should resist that temptation quite fiercely, because all of the past few months have been a reminder that you allow this to go on in any form, and at one point or another, particularly in the quite hysterical time we live in and the age in which our elites and the establishment is particularly hysterical and all over the place, it really won't be long until it reaches someone who you like and agree with.
And if free speech protections only applied to people who believe in free speech, then that basically there's only about 10 of us in the country really that absolutist about it.
No, it's true. I mean, there was something that Dr. Jola said that I did find quite amusing. She was saying in like outside the court that, oh, well, you know, white people, you know, they're not charged for calling each other gammons.
As we do all the time.
Yeah. But there are actually increasingly some on the online right that think people should be judged for calling people gammon. Yeah. So I think, I'm not sure that's going to apply very soon. But
right, let's talk a bit about the Middle East. Essentially, the pretty audacious attack from Israel, although it hasn't claimed responsibility, I think everyone knows that Israel's behind it, on essentially Hezbollah's pager network. Thousands of pagers exploded the other day, believed to have been targeting mostly Hezbollah militants and members and higher-ups. Tom, what have you made of this?
No, it was an incredible, audacious move, as you say. I mean, there was the blowing up of the pagers as well as the walkie-talkies as well, which, as a combination of both, I think it's more than 40 people have been killed, about 2,500 people injured. And it was an attack that really no one saw coming. I mean, this is as a consequence of the fact that in recent months, Hezbollah have been telling their members, their combatants, their soldiers to stop using mobile phones because they realised that the Israeli intelligence services were on top of them as a consequence of that. But somehow, and people are still trying to put together the pieces as to how these pages ended up
in their hands, at what point they were intercepted, at what point they were loaded with these explosives and so on. They've basically pulled off the most remarkable kind of precision attack on terrorists I think we've ever seen. And it's already having all kinds of consequences. I mean, as things might well move on by the time people watch and listen to this, as Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, was giving a televised address today, we're recording on the Thursday, addressing this whole issue and talking about how there are going to be consequences and retaliation and so on. Israel have also begun airstrikes in southern Lebanon and Hezbollah targets as well. All of this does happen in the context of Israel returning the displaced 60,000 people from the north of Israel who've been kind of under fire from Hezbollah since the conflict started. They've made returning those people an actually explicit war aim. So that's also the kind of context in which we're talking about this. So things may well continue to develop and in quite a significant fashion. But it was interesting in the immediate wake of what happened, the kind of speed with which, I suppose you could call it the kind of Tears for Hezbollah crowd came out. And we're talking about this explicitly as a war crime, as another example of horrendous Israeli militarism. And it's obviously worth saying that there were some innocents who died as a consequence of this. There's one little girl in particular. And, you know, any civilian death in the midst of conflict is horrendous, and no one should be relaxed about that. But at the same time, by any feasible standard of warfare, this is it doesn't get much more precision targeted than this. And yet what seems to happen is, if there's any kind of crossfire whatsoever, that now seems to be the bar where Israel is concerned. I mean, literally holding to a standard that no one has ever managed to maintain in the midst of war. And so I just think if this is a war crime, if this is something which is reason to show that not just Israeli aggression, but Israel itself is illegitimate, it shows you that they really can do nothing right, really, in the context of not just this conflict, but in general.
And even just the context, the fact that, you know, Hezbollah has been attacking Israel since the 7th of October, that is often left out of this discussion. It is only the Israeli retaliations that make the news, in this instance, for good reason, because it was so audacious. I mean, the New York Times has suggested that they didn't even intercept the pagers, but they invented a whole network and supply chain of pagers to essentially sell to them, you know, via all these shell companies around the world. I mean, it is extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, it is remarkable. And, you know, more information is going to be revealed over the coming days. And I think, you know, it's really been fascinating for a lot of people because it is, you know, a new development that we may never have seen, you know, in the past at all. But I think, you know, at least for me, the key point is, you know, what Tom said about the fact that it does feel like, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. You know, one of the biggest criticisms of Israel in how it's conducted this war, you know, the arguments which are, you know, compelling to some extent in the sense that, you know, it's a very densely populated area. You know, Palestine, a very young population, all of these types of things. And obviously Israel has come back and said that Hamas is very much embedded in their tunnel network. And they use people as human shields. You know, we're all familiar with some of those arguments that are made. Whereas, you know, in this context, you know, in a different example where it is extremely precise, perhaps one of the most precise examples of, you know, an attack, as you mentioned, you know, there has been innocents killed, but it's still, you know, relatively speaking, very, very precise. You've had all these people coming out and, you know, condemning Israel once again. So it really does just make you think that it isn't really about, you know, completely how Israel is conducting this war. It's that Israel has no right to take any measures to defend itself.
To defend itself, or even to exist in some people's minds, of course.
No, and it's one of those things where all you do is have to think back to the way in which when the Western powers were going after ISIS, you know, for instance, when al-Baghdadi was killed, almost certainly took a fair few innocents with him, unfortunately, in that particular operation. But it would be bizarre for everyone at that particular moment to make that the focus, you know, when the leader of this genocidal terror group had finally been caught up with. And yet the double standard is always there. Maybe that's less surprising from people like Jeremy Corbyn, who have been pretty friendly with Hezbollah for a very long time. But the fact that the kind of mainstreaming of that profound, really sympathy for these terrorist groups amongst the great and good more generally, the reflexive suspicion for anything that Israel does, even as it's fighting what's fundamentally a defensive war on various different fronts now. I mean, we talk a lot about Gaza, obviously, but the Hezbollah piece of the question, the Houthis piece of the question, the Iran front. I mean, all of these things are sometimes skated over. It's
that's one of the things that's been striking post October 7th. There's always been that section of the supposedly kind of anti-imperialist, anti-Israel left who have a tendency to lionize the Islamists and demonize the Israelis. But the way in which that's just become, I don't want to say mainstream, but certainly more widespread than it was previously, is something that's really quite striking in this talk.